Thanks for all your and your colleagues' work in this area. I've been body code for years. Could you talk about the staff response to these units in general? Just the people who don't work in the New York City Department of Corrections. There's a term that's used to describe people whose mental illness was related, who were diagnosed as mentally ill and were therefore either in the special unit in Maui that Homer described, or somehow were not getting into solitary confinement because they're mentally ill. They're called bing beaters. So there's a notion within the Department of Correction that this is that all units like this are designed to beat their disciplinary system. Could you just talk about have you seen any changes, not within the staff who are in the units, but beyond that within this large department?
Yeah, I think that with this first group and this first unit, this the CAPS unit and even the PACE units we've opened, I think that we've gotten pretty decent buy-in from a lot of the senior security folks because they see that these units work better than the old units. So everybody acknowledges that when the Maui, the old solitary, was open, you know, officers and patients really were at their worst behavior, incredibly violent. And so treatment units like this, I think, have better outcomes. So I found very good support for it. I think the problem is that the colloquial acceptance of units like this is pretty much limited to the seriously mentally ill patient. And so I think that patients that are psychotic, you'll hear correction officers and health staff, to be frank, talk about this, that like, yes, that person's really sick, he's really crazy, he really has a problem. And so I think that across the country there's pretty fertile ground for units like this with seriously mentally ill patients. I think that, you know, what's hard for us right now is that most of the patients who have problems in jail are not seriously mentally ill, and those are the patients that grind our systems the most. And so we're really going to be, I think we're facing great challenges to figure out how, with health staff and with security staff, to convince them that, like, you know, the arc of somebody's life who's has a personality disorder, right? That is bent often just or even more acutely than somebody who has a psychotic disorder. If you look at somebody who's schizophrenic and receives treatment, you know, versus somebody who has some access to disorder we've identified or something, those people are in and out of jail and prison and end up with horrible outcomes. But we don't acknowledge often that those are real problems, and this, I don't think the security staff do. And so that's where I think we're in for a much tougher go of it when we try and expand this model. Yeah, Jack.
Yes, I'm Jack Ritter from Chicago. I'm very impressive. I think this is a model well throughout the country. I think you're correct that the population that we're put in segregation, they regress, whether they're seriously mentally ill or behaviorally challenged. And I think that by addressing serious mentally ill is the proper way to start. I do think the next step is to go after those who are maybe the non-psychotropic treatable patient who needs on themselves who progresses when you get them away. I think you're setting the model that might work in both settings. And I think socialization is important with the AIDS example, maybe a model that you've replicated in other settings. I just think, as you said, this consumes mental health and medical resources in jails and prisons. It's very bad outcome. So I applaud you and I applaud the way this has been put together and so concisely related to us.
Thanks. Thank you. Okay. Then we can launch into a discussion about Homeland Security detention, which is maybe a little bit less known or a little bit less apparent. So my faculty position and my faculty research has to do with looking at the conditions of confinement for immigrants that have been detained by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. So that's through NYU. And you may know that across the country today, there are about 33,000 people that are in detention settings that are being held not as part of a criminal justice process, but as part of the immigration process. And so this is something that happens in most countries around the world, but the U.S., like with the criminal justice system, is really far ahead and out in front in terms of the number of immigrants that are detained, and that this entire process of detaining immigrants and deporting them has a small fraction of the oversight or data or accountability that we see in the traditional criminal justice system we were just talking about. And so I wanted to, when I started as a fellow, this was my fellowship project about 7 or 8 years ago, looking at this, we had a lot of concerns about mortality and morbidity. These detention settings are short stay, so people are in and out, a little bit like a jail. But we've been tracking this, and so recently we were able to obtain some data, and this is an analysis of mortality over the years, and it's provocative, and I think we want to think about how to interpret it and elicit your opinions. I don't have any disclosures to report. For the last several years, about 400,000 people a year are detained by ICE, and ICE is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Since 2005, the new iteration of INS. This is the group that's responsible for holding immigrants that are found out of status. ICE detainees are held all over the country. They could be held in county jails. They could be held in private, like Jack in the Box detention centers. Over in Elizabeth, New Jersey, we have the Elizabeth Detention Center is literally a food warehouse that was made into a people warehouse. And it's run by CCA, one of the private for-profit corporations. ICE has a few facilities of its own that are bigger and a little bit more robust, but there is a wide variety. And as we'll get into, because this is incredibly profitable and pretty low risk, if you just look at this from a business standpoint, whether you're a private entrepreneur or you're a county, there's a lot of reasons to get into this business because it's a real, effective and reliable cash transfer from the federal government to localities and private businesses. And the medical services are spotty and they're hard to quantify in terms of how consistent they are. And we've written a lot about this over the years. So I do want to give you kind of some context. There are a few things that have happened recently that I wanted to put in mind as we talk about the change in the mortality rates. So ICE has always had a relationship with the Public Health Service to use some of the Public Health Service docs in some of the ICE detention centers. And so they, a couple of years ago, created their own cadre, the ICE Health Service Corps. It relies on Public Health Service docs, and not just docs, but medical personnel and administrators who are highly trained, who have a good standard of care, and they work and ICE has been working to expand their footprint in ICE detention centers, although it's still, probably less than half of the people are held in a place with this level of resource. Second thing is there's a couple of programs that ICE has used to basically suck up people from the criminal justice system into ICE detention. And so there's a couple of wonky names. One is called 287G and one is called Secure Communities. But these programs basically do two things. One is they deputize local sheriffs and police departments as kind of representatives of ICE so that they can actually grab people and put them directly into ICE. The other is there's another program that allows, it brings federal dollars in to coordinate the transfer from jail or prison into ICE so that somebody's in jail for some reason or prison for some reason. ICE comes into that county or that city and says, here's some money, we'll buy you a bunch of computers, we'll bring our staff in, and we'll work with you to coordinate the safe and effective and timely transfer of people as they leave jail so they don't go to the street and they go straight into custody. So those programs really flowered during the period of this data analysis, and it's important to think about because then for each of those people, think about it, if they're coming from jail or prison, they've gone through whatever that jail or prison's medical process is, and a lot of the kind of high morbidity and mortality times when you first get to jail, all of that is on the books for the jailers, for the criminal justice system, not for ICE, who's picking them up a little bit later. ICE also has rolled out more health policies, that trying to standardize some of the healthcare they deliver. And they have, in the last 4 years, tried to have fewer, or 5 years, fewer patients or fewer detainees in local county jails. So there has been a move in that direction. So I wanted to just put that out there as context. So through a Freedom of Information Act request, there was data over more than 10 years provided that basically was a huge spreadsheet that ICE had of all the deaths with, you know, probably 15 or 20 columns of data, the name of the person, the location of death, their age, some very rudimentary description of cause of death, but usually before an autopsy had been done and not always very reliable. And so the years where we had the full year of data are 04 through 14, so that's 143. The 150 deaths, that number's larger because there were a few, there were some deaths in 03 and some deaths in 15 for which we didn't have the full year. So we used, when we look at cause of death, we looked at all the deaths, 150, but then the year-by-year analysis, we just did the full years, the 143. So we looked at death rate, we accrued death rate, and we looked at, we compiled it a couple of different ways, one looking at average daily population and one looking at number of admissions. Sometimes we found in different settings that these can be, you know, you could have some differences, but the most dramatic take-home message is that the rate of mortality has plummeted, you know, to a fraction of what it was, right? And so this is incredibly, we'll talk in a minute about how to interpret this, but it's very dramatic. When we look at the cause of death in this data set, again, this is tempered by the fact that it's myself and Dr. Keller, who's my partner at Bellevue Program for Survivors of Torture, us going through these brief notations by ICE. So this is not medical records review and categorizing them. But, you know, as you see, this dispersion looks a lot like what you would see in correctional settings, that your cardiovascular and oncology deaths are the predominant ones. A couple other findings. So county jails and private detention centers, 54% of the deaths occurred in those settings, but 80% of suicides occurred in those settings. And one private setting, Eloy, which is in Arizona, had a quarter of all the suicides. And this is one of the, this facility happens to be one of the facilities that advocates have called to be, to have shut down. It, however, as you go south, you get into some of these very large super facilities that are very big. There's a lot of investment in them because you need ICE, you know, from their perspective, they need big facilities near the border where they can suck people in from all over the country, hold them, and then have them go out. And then the daily census, when at the beginning of this data set, you know, there were only 20,000 people in the system, and now it's 33,000, and I'll get into a minute the bed mandate and why it continues to be so so large. And then the greatest declines by rate were in the years 2004 to 2007. So the first thing I'll say is this decrease in crude mortality rate is just unlike anything I've ever seen in data from any other setting. So we, for instance, published a 10-year mortality retrospective from the New York City system roughly during these same years through this 2000 to 2009. And we said we had like a 30-35% decrease in mortality. I mean, a little staccato up, down in those same years because we were looking at Bureau of Justice Statistics data. You know, there was like a 10 or 15% decrease in national jail deaths. So, and we, you know, we're able to look back in our system in New York City and look at how many more resources we were putting in, think about systems that had changed, think about really a lot of this decrease in jails is the decrease in HIV mortality. That's the single greatest thing that you would identify. But I've never seen a correctional setting go from you know, basically cut its rate of mortality to, you know, an eighth of what it was. So it's very striking, and I think that then it causes us to really think hard about what's going on here. I think that, to be fair to ICE, there are things that they've done to work to improve healthcare inside the detention settings, and so I mentioned a few of them. I think that those are probably helpful, and I don't doubt that those have an impact. However, I think that it is also quite likely that that big changes in the demographics of who and how people come through these settings really have a big impact on such a dramatic decrease in mortality. So the criminal justice links to ICE, you know, this idea that an increasing share of the people who go into detention have already been kind of pre-cleared by county jails and prisons, and if they were going to have bad outcomes, you know, imagine somebody who comes into jail, is undocumented, they're in jail for a brief amount of time, and they die through alcohol withdrawal, through seizure, through whatever. That person, they may otherwise have gone to ICE, but because of the programs that are set up, they don't. And so I think that, you know, it may be that some of the mortality has shifted out of the ICE setting because ICE is not picking these people up. Because while that person may have died whether or not ICE existed because they were in jail, previously ICE's approach would have been to go find that person on the street and bring them in and kind of redo the same thing again. And then I think that there's an increasing group of people also are not getting into ICE detention at all because they're being handled by Border Patrol. So there's a process called expedited removal, which basically involves people being quickly grabbed up and then leaving the country fast, being deported quickly. And while some of this expedited removal happens with ICE, a lot of it happens with Border Patrol, who's at the border finding people and then taking them back. And so I think it's possible that the increase in this activity around the border may also, there may be mortality there. So I'll just mention quickly the bed mandate. So does anybody not know what the bed mandate is? So an important feature of of immigration in this country is that ICE is mandated to keep about 34,000 beds filled with immigrants every day. And so this is an appropriations bill, and ICE, if they wanted to reduce the number of people in jail, it's hard for them. They can't. They're held to account for this by Congress. And so really this is functionally just a guaranteed cash transfer from the federal government to really to a lot of red states, but to people who are in the business of detaining folks. And so if you're a county jail in, you know, someplace that has a big immigration detention program, it means that the profit you make on holding these immigrants, which could be from $20 to $40 profit per day, you know, like it depends on what you're getting reimbursed locally, but it's a guaranteed profit for not just for the private vendors that we like to vilify, but for counties, right? For counties that have money coming in to their sheriff's departments, to tax bases, and really that's all made possible by the bed mandate, which says you must have this many people locked up all the time. So the bed, now that comprehensive immigration has kind of fallen by the wayside, I'd say the most important or the one of the primary focuses for immigration advocates is this bed mandate, is to take a crack at it and get it rescinded so that ICE can do what every other what the criminal justice system does, which is have a debate about what do you need, not simply mandate that you keep this many people detained. The local participation in these criminal justice partnerships, I mentioned them, those are a little bit on the wane. You may have seen around the country different articles for the last 2 or 3 years, really, that some cities are deciding they're not going to participate in these programs. So the first one, 287G, stopped. That program stopped. So the federal government, President Obama, stopped that program. That's the deputizing program. But the second part, Secure Communities, it got rebranded and renamed as the Priority Enforcement Program, but it's still this coordination, this notion of coordinating. And some places, you know, New York City, the city council actually passed 3 resolutions over about 5 years. The first being they couldn't coordinate in one way, the second being they couldn't coordinate another way, and then the third one was just get off of Rikers Island. Get out of your trailer, get off of Rikers Island. And so ICE is now, you know, so I think that some cities are taking this approach. The problem is that when you do that, the federal dollars that come with that to assist the program go away also. So I think that we need more analysis of these Border Patrol, the post. And the other thing is we're blind to when people die when they get home. So if you do just a better job of getting people out of the country and dropping them off in Mexico or in El Salvador or Honduras, you know, and you've given them a piece of paper that says, here's where you can go for your dialysis for $150 three times a week, you know, we don't know what happens to those people. And so we're really blind from an epidemiologic standpoint to where the potential shift in these mortality outcomes have been pushed to. So I just want to thank my partners at the Survivors of Torture. Also, I want to thank ICE because ICE gave us access to this data, and also as we were preparing this analysis, you know, they will have a different interpretation of this data when we publish it, but they were very kind to share, you know, the length of stay data and a lot of other important data points that we didn't have. So thank you.